In the section of Matthew's Gospel that we read today, which is the latter portion of chapter 26 and into chapter 27, the passion, right, which is simply the suffering continues and particularly really picks up speed as Jesus is abandoned by his disciples at his arrest in the garden, as he is then rejected and vilified by his own people at his first trial, then as he is betrayed in different ways by both Judas and Peter, kind of the two opposite spectrums of his disciples, and then at his second trial, as he's denied justice by the governor, who freely admits that he's innocent, but is just unwilling to take the trouble and count the political cost to defend him. But since the start of Matthew's Gospel, the main theme has really been, more than the other Gospels, the coming of God's kingdom on earth. Okay, so just kind of a reminder of what we were kind of digging out at the very beginning of the Gospel, is that God has promised from the very Garden of Eden, right, implicit in creation itself is this promise that God will reign over the world and that it will be a thriving world of peace, of justice, of equality, of prosperity, all those things that we just innately long for. And Matthew advertised in the beginning, if you can think way back to last November and the Old Testament texts that we were digging out that Matthew was referring to in the very beginning of the Gospel, he advertised in this bold manner that his gospel was going to be the beginning of how that happens, of how God's kingdom actually comes. And so the question becomes especially pressing here as we watch Jesus' suffering. As the story progresses, I mean, literally in the worst possible way, right, as we watch Jesus abandoned, condemned, humiliated, all the opposite of the things that we expect, and then finally executed, we're supposed to be wondering the whole time, how does this bring God's kingdom? So, like last week, I want to take the time to read through the entire passage, not because we're going to pull apart and talk about everything that's there, right? But just because it is so important. So we're going to read the entire passage, but then I'm going to focus on one particular Old Testament reference that I think really deepens our understanding of this question of how does the kingdom come. So this is Matthew, picking up from chapter 26, verse 47, where we left it last week in the garden. And then we'll go through the conclusion of the trial before Pilate at 27:26. While he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived. With him was a large crowd armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him." Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed him. Jesus replied, "Friend, do what you came for." Then the men stepped forward, seized Jesus, and arrested him. With that, one of Jesus' companions reached for his sword, drew it out, and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. "Put your sword back in its place," Jesus said to him, "for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Do you think I cannot call on my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? But how then would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen in this way?" At that time, Jesus said to the crowd, "Am I leading a rebellion that you've come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I sat in the temple courts teaching, and you did not arrest me. But this has all taken place that the writings of the prophets might be fulfilled." Then all the disciples deserted him and fled. Those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the teachers of the law and the elders had assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance, right up to the courtyard of the high priest. He entered and sat down with the guards to see the outcome. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. "But I say to all of you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" "He is worthy of death," they answered. Then they spit in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, Christ. Who hit you?" Now Peter was sitting out in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him. "You also were with Jesus of Galilee," she said. But he denied it before them all. "I don't know what you're talking about," he said. Then he went out to the gateway, where another girl saw him and said to the people there, "This fellow was with Jesus of Nazareth." He denied it again, and with an oath, "I don't know the man." After a little while, those standing there went up to Peter and said, "Surely you're one of them, for your accent gives you away." Then he began to call down curses on himself, and he swore to them, "I don't know the man." Immediately, a rooster crowed. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken, "Before the rooster crows, you will disown me 3 times." And he went outside and wept bitterly. Early in the morning, all the chief priests and the elders of the people came to the decision to put Jesus to death. They bound him, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate, the governor. When Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 silver coins to the chief priests and the elders. "I have sinned," he said, "for I have betrayed innocent blood." "What is that to us?" they replied. "That's your responsibility." So Judas threw the money into the temple and left. Then he went away and hanged himself. The chief priests picked up the coins and said, "It is against the law to put this into the treasury, since it is blood money." So they decided to use the money to buy the potter's field as a burial place for foreigners. That is why it has been called the Field of Blood to this day. Then what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. They took the 30 silver coins, the price set on him by the people of Israel, and they used them to buy the potter's field, as the Lord commanded me. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. When he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate asked him, "Don't you hear the testimony they are bringing against you?" But Jesus made no reply, not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor. Now it was the governor's custom at the feast to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, "Which one do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?" For he knew It was out of envy that they had handed Jesus over to him. While Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him this message: "Don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him." But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" asked the governor. "Barabbas," they answered. "What shall I do then with Jesus, who's called Christ?" Pilate asked. They all answered, "Crucify him." "Why? What crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him." When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. "I am innocent of this man's blood," he said. "It is your responsibility." All the people answered, "Let his blood be on us and on our children." Then he released Barabbas to them, but he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. The word of God for the people of God. So, last week, John came up to me and said, "I could feel how much you passed over, right?" Well, even more so this week. You know, there's just so much there. You know, whatever biblical idea you want to trace, whatever theme you find through Scripture, it's here somewhere, making some critical. This literally is the climax of everything that shows up anywhere in the Bible. Every different angle you take, whichever idea is in your head when you read this passage, you see something new there. But like I said, I want to focus on the idea of God's kingdom, which has clearly been central to Matthew from the very beginning of the gospel. And like I said, while the idea of the coming of the kingdom shows up in all the gospels, is more central to Matthew than to any of the others. And I said that as we watch the unthinkable transpire, we're supposed to be wondering, how does this bring God's kingdom? Okay? And what I want to zero in on is when Jesus stands before the high priest and he's pressed with this solemn oath, right? And the high priest very consciously invokes the name of God, right? Which the Jews never did. They always referred to God in these very roundabout ways. He invokes the name of God, and it's not just anybody doing this. It is the high priest laying this oath on Jesus to declare plainly. Jesus says in his answer, "From now on," okay, the NIV translates it "in the future," but it's not really in the future. That sounds very kind of vague and far off. The phrase was literally "from now on." It's much more immediate to the event that is actually happening. "From now on, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Okay? Now, we're going to dig into what Jesus, why he uses those words. But just at the very level of kind of what's happening in the discussion, what Jesus is essentially saying is, although you condemn me, you will very shortly see me vindicated by God. Okay? Primarily, Jesus is making a statement about his own vindication, although he stands condemned. And the whole idea there of "you will see," I think most likely refers to the resurrection itself. Now, that doesn't mean that the high priest and the others there gathered are going to literally see Jesus coming on a cloud at the time of the resurrection. And we're going to get into why Jesus uses those words. But in the general sense that this is referring to vindication, and the fact that he's speaking to these individuals and saying, "You will experience this." Because remember, to see often doesn't mean literally to perceive with your eyes. It means to experience firsthand. He's telling them that they will experience Jesus's vindication. And that's why I believe that this is primarily referring to the resurrection that's going to happen very shortly. And these chief priests, after they condemn him and think that they're done with this loser, are going to be smacked up against the fact that God himself says, oh no. But then I do believe that it also refers more distantly to the second coming. But the way that Jesus says this, he doesn't say, I don't care what you do, God will vindicate me. Okay? He uses the words from two very, very, very well-known passages from the Old Testament. Passages that absolutely certainly the people he is speaking to, the chief priests, would recognize. Passages that Matthew absolutely recognizes and is intentionally invoking as he records these words, and words that any Jew or Greek who's attending synagogue at the time, right, Matthew's readers, also would have picked up on. Jesus' answer refers to these two well-known passages which are specifically about God's kingdom. And particularly, they are about God giving not just some authority, like Old Testament kings, but giving his full authority and power to a human king who will rule over the whole world as one with God. Okay? Jesus' answer begins and ends with references to the vision of Daniel 7, and then right in the middle, Jesus inserts a line from Psalm 110. Okay, so we're going to look at Daniel 7, and I know that this passage, to some people, they already know what passage I'm referring to, and as I make references to it, they'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Other people, it's maybe kind of, yeah, once I start talking about it, you're like, oh yeah, okay, that thing. Other people, this may be absolutely completely new. I don't have time to deal with it as though it's completely new to everyone. So I would encourage you to open up Daniel 7. I meant to have the page number ready, but that won't take more than a second. You can open up Daniel 7. It's actually not too far back from Matthew. This would be on page 881 if you want to use the Pew Bible, although we're actually going to be looking at the part on 882. And you can just have it there open and let your eye bounce over the page as I refer to things there. But essentially, in Daniel 7, Daniel has a vision in which he sees a series of progressively more and more terrifying beasts that represent the successive kingdoms of mankind. Okay? And if you have any study Bible, the footnote there is going to tell you which kingdoms these represent. Okay? And they'll tell you that they represent successively Babylon, then Persia, then Greece under Alexander, and then Rome. And that's correct. But one of the problems with is you nail that little detail down and you think, okay, now I've understood it. But there's something actually more important, well, maybe not more important, more general going on here. The more general point with these kingdoms being represented in this way is that when humanity, which was created to have authority and was given dominion over creation, when humanity rules in its own authority, independently of God, it becomes beastly. Humanity, which shares flesh with all the rest of the animals of the world, right? When science says that, you know, we're really no different from all the other mammals, there's an incredibly good theological point there. We are. We are part of creation. But we've been exalted above creation by God's purpose, by his call to rise above the beasts, to become like God and to rule over creation in his name, in dependence on him, by bearing his divine image. And when we try to do that independently of God, we not only can't escape our own beasthood, but we become worse than, we become more depraved than the natural beasts. We become monstrous. We were supposed to reflect who God is and rise above beastliness. But wherever we exercise power independently of God, like the chief priest to whom Jesus is speaking to, and like Pilate, before whom he's about to stand, humanity becomes debased and becomes even more monstrous than the beasts we're supposed to rule over. But then, this series of the degradation of human authority and power is interrupted. Because in Daniel's vision, God shows up to judge. That's there in verse 9, right? With the Ancient of Days showing up and putting down these thrones and judging these beastly empires. But then, as God shows up to judge, we're told in Daniel 7, 13 and 14, that one like a son of man, notice the contrast here with the beastly empires, one like a son of man, one meaning a human being, one like Adam, was coming with the clouds of heaven. Now, when we hear coming with the clouds of heaven, our thoughts immediately go to what? The second coming. Jesus coming to earth on the clouds of heaven in all his divine glory. But here, where is the scene set? Here the scene is set at God's throne for the judgment. And here this human being, the son of Adam, the son of man, is being carried not to earth, but he's being carried into the presence of God. He's being carried to God's throne. And what happens there? He approached the Ancient of Days, that's God, and was led into his presence. Now again, if we're students of the big biblical story, this is huge. A human being entering the presence of God, being accepted into God's presence, right? This is the ultimate end of the exile. This is humanity, the prodigal son coming home. This is Adam re-entering not the Garden of Eden, but what the Garden of Eden was supposed to become. Okay? This is climax. And then think how shocking the next bit is if we, like deeply, passionately monotheistic Jews of the first century, are insistent that the glory and power are God's and God's alone, and I will share my glory with none. When he's speaking about idols, okay? Think how shocking the next line is. And he, the Son of Man, this Adam figure, humanity, was given authority, was given glory in God's presence, was given sovereign power. And if that's not too much for you, and all peoples, nation and men of every language, worshiped. We have a human being clothed with the glory of God, seated on God's throne, being worshipped. Daniel foresees a human being who will receive all of God's power and glory in order to rule and even be worshipped. The archangels throw a fit when people try to worship them. And even be worshipped sitting on God's throne for all eternity. Okay? When humanity tries to rule without God, he becomes depraved, worse than the beasts. But when he takes his proper place under God's authority, ruling in God's as God's image, he's exalted, he's glorified, he becomes like God. And we have to understand that this is what was always intended for humanity. This was God's plan when he created Adam. This is what God has been wanting to do for all of history. And Daniel sees God fulfilling Adam's destiny in the person of this eternal chosen king who will be the very image of God. And yes, your brain jumps to Hebrew 1. Good. We see the Son of Man succeeding where the father of man, Adam, failed. And so Jesus, on a superficial level, says, you will see me vindicated by God. But he's also referring to that big story and saying to the high priest, that's me. And in the middle of that reference to Daniel 7, Jesus sticks in a line from Psalm 110 about sitting at the right hand of God. Okay? That line fits the imagery of Daniel 7, but the words are actually taken from Psalm 110. Now, Psalm 10, if you look at it, and this is going to be a little bit briefer than Daniel 7. If you look at Psalm 10, it's a celebration of God's chosen king being enthroned, but not just enthroned to be king, enthroned in order to wield God's own power throughout all the earth. Okay? The problem isn't who gets to sit on the throne. The problem is that the world is in chaos and needs a righteous king, and God's answer is the enthronement of his chosen king in order to subdue the nations. So in Psalm 10, there's language specifically about crushing the kings and rulers who are opposed to God's reign. Right? And we remember that all through Matthew, there's been this strong theme of salvation through judgment. Okay? And in Psalm 10, that's what we have. The salvation of the earth, the restoration of God's intention through the judgment of opposition. And not through just anyone. Because, Ralph, you're not worthy to judge. Neither are any of you. And in Revelation, we cry out, who is worthy? To open the scroll. What is the scroll? It's a scroll of condemnation. It's a curse on those who oppose God's will. Who's worthy to judge? God's king. The one that God exalts on his throne. Now, some of you may be remembering Psalm 2. Later today, open up Psalm 2. You'll see it's very, very similar to the same idea that we see in Psalm 110. God enthrones his king in order to crush the rulers and kings who oppose God's will. Because God's will is good for the whole world. The world itself is crying out, waiting for God's reign. Now, the high priest. Keep in mind that the high priest is not the high priest the way that we read about the high priesthood in Numbers and Leviticus. Okay? The high priest at this day was a political person. The Romans had taken over. And the high priesthood, a series of high priests, had learned that you make it work with the Romans and they let you do what you want. In the absence of a Jewish king, the high priest essentially sat on the throne of David. The high priest was not a religious figure. He was a political figure, wielding power in Jerusalem because he gets along with the Romans. He hates them, but he's learned to work with them. And this high priest, who was a political beast, would have thought of the coming Christ in very military political terms, as would many of in his day. They expected a Christ to be an actual Jewish king who would lead a rebellion, drive out the Romans, and sit on the throne of David, reestablishing a Jewish kingdom based in Jerusalem. And so this high priest that Jesus is talking to has learned to get along with the Romans pretty well, and in the absence of a Jewish king, is the one sitting on the throne of David. And so Jesus, the high priest's question, are you the Christ? He's not asking this because, oh, maybe he really is and will lead us into all the promises promised to our forefather Abraham. That's not what the high priest is interested in. He's interested in his power, his prestige, his politics, his money. His question is much more, do you think, you, look at yourself, do you think that by claiming the throne of David, you can take my place? Do you know what the Romans will do to you? Let's see. And so Jesus' answer takes on another level when he says, not only that, not only do I think I can take your place on the throne of David, but God will vindicate me over you by giving me his own glory and even his throne in order to judge you and the Romans. And all the world will worship God by worshiping me. No wonder they cry, blasphemy! Okay? Because they pick up on all these levels. They know the language Jesus is speaking. When we see the injustice, when we see the violence of the passion, and we ask, how does this bring about God's kingdom? Matthew uses the Old Testament to point us to the answer. When the authorities put Jesus to death, they are effectively delivering Jesus up to God to be enthroned, and in the process, cementing their own guilt so that when God comes to judge the beastly manifestations of human authority and power, the whole world can't say anything except, righteous are you, O Lord. Daniel 7 is simply another telling of the same story that we saw in Zechariah, with the story of the shepherd king, who was not only rejected by the wicked shepherds, but by the sheep themselves, sold for 30 pieces of silver and pierced, yet raised up by God in order to return and grant the people a new heart and lead them into God's kingdom. Right? The story from Zechariah that we talked about last week. And finally, at the risk of going long, I do want to pose one more question. Why is this necessary? Why the rejection? Why the suffering? Why the horror? Why particularly this path to the throne? Why couldn't God have just exalted him to glory and power without the suffering? Why this convoluted route to glory? And the answer is our guilt. Without dealing with our guilt, without dealing with the rebellion and the godlessness and the independence that each one of us has exhibited, Adam's sin that we each ratify in our own choices, without dealing with our disobedience, Jesus' glorification would be for him alone. Jesus would be united with God, and all of humanity would be condemned. And that's not God's plan. God's plan has always been to glorify humanity, to unite humanity to himself. And in order to bring the rest of humanity with him, our guilt has to be dealt with. And so here, without quoting the Old Testament directly, Matthew points us to an answer to this question as well, when he emphasizes Jesus' silence in front of both Caiaphas and Pilate. And again, the passage that he refers to there is so familiar to any Jew or Greek attending a synagogue in Matthew's day that when he emphasizes Jesus' silence before the authorities, anyone would have immediately thought of a passage in Isaiah. Isaiah 53. And I'll close with those words. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him, afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. Amen.